Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. First case for this morning is Trump versus Western Southern Life Insurance. Mr. Holstein?
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Robert Holstein. I'm pleased to appear before you this morning, Your Honor. I believe, by way of introduction, there's two things that are of great interest to me personally, and I think the rest of the court. First of all, the issue of insurance generally, I think, is an extremely important institution. There wouldn't have been a lot of advances in the industrialization of our world and so forth without it. We have an overreaching insurance company here that has gone beyond the bounds. The other thing of interest is Rule 23 in class actions. Oftentimes, the plaintiff's bar is criticized. On the other hand, Rule 23 is not a plaintiff's tool. It's equally a corporate tool. But when a corporation goes beyond the bounds of Rule 23 and what it's meant to do, which is to provide corporate resolution, an attempt by fashioning a release in a class settlement that is so broad, so with such depth and such scope, far beyond the complaint and far beyond the settlement intention that could possibly be represented by the representative plaintiffs who entered into such a settlement, there's an abuse by the defense bar and the abuse by the corporate defendant who is using that settlement to clean up over 100 years of tortious conduct,
That's really kind of an extreme statement. I mean, the Ohio court found that this particular settlement was a reasonable resolution of the class action pending before it, and as is appropriate in such situations, notice of the settlement and an opportunity to opt out of it was given to the class members. And I presume, as usual, some opted out and most didn't in this kind of situation. What you're describing is really doesn't bear any relation to the ordinary practice of class action settlements. This particular class action settlement, which the district court has set forth in its opinion, didn't strike me as so utterly out of bounds as to make me think that this court was supposed to conduct a collateral attack on what the Ohio court found to be a reasonable settlement.
Judge, we're not asking for a collateral attack. We're asked to look at the record.
Well, you are asking us to say that either the scope of this class action is different from the scope of the claim that you're bringing, or that there was something so fundamentally unrepresentative about the Ohio representatives and under principles of cases like Hansberry against Lee and the like, your client shouldn't be bound by the results in any event.
Your Honor, the Creedler case was a vanishing premium case. We had Prudential, one of the largest class action settlements in the last century, was a vanishing premium. There were literally hundreds of vanishing premium settlements. That is a specific policy of insurance. It's a specifically interest-sensitive policy. It has nothing to do with a burial policy, which is a standard policy sold picking up premium at 25 cents a week or a month. Going on, it's called a debit policy. It has nothing to do with the kind of policy that my client was involved in. It is so fairly remote, and we presented evidence to the court in the Bonovich expert affidavit that the Creedler policies that were at issue in that case by those representative plaintiffs in that class settlement had nothing to do with the tortious conduct, because tortious conduct, Your Honor, was overbilling in a premium notice at the end of the year.
You made that perfectly clear in your brief, but all I'm saying is we need to deal with both the points that you've made and also the points that the Ohio trial court made. That court defined policy or policies to mean one or more individual permanent life insurance policies, i.e. traditional life and universal life policies, et cetera, issued, and so on. There are actual legal definitions that we need to deal with. You've made crystal clear your position that the kind of policy that your client had is different from this kind of policy. The district court read what the Ohio court was describing, and the plain fact that your client, that somebody thought your client was in the class, or they wouldn't have bothered to send a notice. You know, we just have to decide that. I mean, standing on the podium isn't going to make us decide it any differently.
Your Honor, the notice, we didn't have a chance because the court just cut us off summarily. But I'm willing to bet that an inquiry would show that they sent a notice to every policy holder of every policy taken out during that policy period, regardless of the type of policy that they sold. So they tried to funnel all their conduct into a release. This was essentially buying insurance for future claims for all their business that they did in that period of time, whether it had any relationship to the class representative claims or not. They entered into a settlement. They knew the Vantage and Premium was going to go. It was going all over the United States. So they said, okay, we'll settle this, but we're going to have a release that settles any other claims that might come in that have nothing to do with this. So they purchased their own insurance for their own period of time against all future claims. And this is a perfect example of it. And the court wouldn't allow our inquiry. We never got there, even though we had affidavits that were accepted in one instance, and in another instance, the court paid no attention to them, saying that our case was totally different than the Creeler case. It deserves an inquiry. The class action should not be used as a weapon by virtue of a settlement. It's not designed for that. You should get corporate resolution, legitimate corporate issues that are before the court in the settlement. To take and buy off and pay off plaintiff's lawyers to submit to a settlement that allows that bigger release so that they can go and shield themselves for all activities is not what it's designed for.
Counsel, do you want to address your jurisdictional argument?
Well,
maybe you don't.
Yeah, the court wanted me to say something at the time. If I had to do it again, I would have provided the court with assistance. I don't think the Supreme Court, in its pronouncements long, a year before this case was before the trial court, imposed that duty on the lawyers. I don't think it was my duty. I didn't want to be appearing as forum shopping. I meant it as a joke.
You can't mean to say that you didn't think it was your responsibility to assist the court in determining whether it had jurisdiction.
When I told the court, and the court didn't think it was funny, but I meant my office is exactly in between the state court, exactly to the foot, to the federal court. I have no problem litigating. I love it here. I love it there. I didn't want it to appear that I wanted to leave the court for any reason. I didn't want to prejudice my client's position. And that's why the judge...
Let me assure you, the court would not have taken it personally if you had presented a legal argument about whether or not the requirements of 28 U.S.C. Section 1332 were met.
The court, one could look at it, and if you really wanted to accept jurisdiction, maybe a lawyer could argue that way. But I didn't want to take a position because that's the court's decision. It's not my decision. I didn't care where I litigated.
Well, but when we talk about meeting the $75,000 requirement, the court has to be assisted. It can't just pull numbers out of thin air.
Your Honor, it's not a face of putting. This is... this is a $3,500. This is not a $75,000 case. You didn't have to be a rocket scientist to see it. And I really have nothing more to say about it. It shouldn't be here, but that's not for me. The court should look at that. That's
Well, we will.
May it please the court, Philip Stano, representing Defendant Appellee to Western Southern Life Insurance. I would like to address the two issues that seem to be uppermost in the court's mind here today, the jurisdictional amount issue and the impact of the Kreidler settlement. And I'll take them in logical order, starting with jurisdiction first. Before turning to jurisdiction, the amount in controversy, let me say that it appears that diversity of citizenship is not an issue at this time in this case. Plaintiff has conceded that she is a citizen of the state of Illinois, and the record clearly indicates that Western Southern has its principal place of business in Ohio and is incorporated in the state of Ohio. Turning to amount in controversy, plaintiff obviously conceded that point at trial by not denying the affidavits that Western Southern had offered at trial and appears to be objecting now. I realize that's not determinative, but that does sort of put plaintiff's argument in context. As a preliminary matter, the law in the circuit is clear that you look to the original complaint and determine the amount in controversy. And if it's not clear from the original complaint, you look at the record in the whole. Defendant Western Southern has the burden of proof in this case, and that burden must be met by a preponderance of the evidence. And by
let me tell you what worried me a little bit about your argument, Mr. Stano, which was the cost of compliance calculations in your affidavit, because I think we all agree that in the posture of this case, it's the individual that we need to look at. We're not aggregating anything about classes or doing anything. This is an individual case.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And this one individual policy or this one individual's case really doesn't implicate 43 different states and every form, you know, the company has ever devised. I would say at the most, it could only focus on the costs of changing the one form or the one type of policy that this lady had. I thought that was only about $31,000.
Well, Your Honor, that's not correct, because Western Southern operates in 44 jurisdictions. They are the policy reformation request, which plaintiff has made in the complaint, implicates.
But why? I mean, it's only hers. Remember, the complaint was trying to be a class complaint, too, and I think we need to peel it back to what the individual case would be.
That's correct.
And she wouldn't even have standing to ask, you know, that you reform some California policy or an Ohio policy. She doesn't have one. She never will have one.
You're absolutely correct, Your Honor, but that's not the analysis we propose, and that's not the testimony of the affidavit. Assuming, for example, this was an individual case only with no request for class.
That's what I think we need to do,
okay,
right, to start with.
Right.
Yeah.
We're not aggregating the class. The class is irrelevant for purposes of determining.
Right. And so the other 42 states are also irrelevant, it seems to me.
They're not, Your Honor, for this reason. Despite the fact that we're talking, let's assume this is an individual case only, the laws, the mandates of the statutes are there. And when you provide a benefit to someone, when you treat them in a preferred way, and that would be the case if the court were to grant plaintiff's request for injunctive relief, then those statutes are implicated.
I understand. Are you telling me that your company doesn't have any differences between its Illinois policies and its Ohio policies and its Texas policies and its New York policies?
Not for the same class. Now, there might be minor variations in the wording, but the premium rates are done on a nationwide basis. That's the only way to do it administratively. Premiums are based.
That's your administrative convenience, but that means you don't have to revise it a million times either. I mean, you revise it once.
But, Your Honor, what's at stake here, what the exposure is here, and what would be required to make the changes would be the premium rate and the amount of coverage based on whatever policy reformation occurred. That's done on a nationwide basis. Now, a state may have some administrative differences. For example, the print may have to be in a certain type, or you must have a certain provision on one policy page. But with regard to pricing and determining and classification of risk, that's done on a nationwide basis. You affect one policyholder. You affect everyone in that class nationwide. So the laws of the 44 states, or the jurisdictions, which is where Western Southern is licensed, are indeed implicated. And if we weren't clear of it, let me say this now, we are looking at this as if relief were given to plaintiff on an individual basis only. Forget the class allegations.
Well, right. I mean, that's the thing that I'm curious that it needs to be blown up. I really wonder if this is the argument you would have been making if, in fact, this case had, for other reasons, gone forward, or whether you instead might have found some way to settle the case with her alone or in other ways not blown it up into such a major proposition.
Your Honor, it's not blown up. Under the Seventh Circuit cases, which I'm sure the Court's very aware, you look at the object of the litigation. The cost of compliance, as we all know, is a necessary factor in evaluating the cost of the injunctive relief. And the cost of compliance is real because the company has exposure in every jurisdiction where it does business if it does not comply. And that is the testimony from the 8 witnesses who gave affidavits. That's what the statutes say, and that's what the cases say. Insurance is unique in that it's one of the few industries that has such an anti-discrimination statute. And it wouldn't apply to every case where injunctive relief is sought because it only applies to where cases where the policyholder, where the risk is implicated, where the relationship between the policyholder and the policy, the language has changed. And in a lot of the market conduct cases, which I'm sure this Court has seen, it would not be applicable if injunctive relief were granted. Say, for example, they're alleging deceptive sales practices or breach of contract or improper agent training. That does not implicate the anti-discrimination statutes. It just so happens that the request for injunctive relief that plaintiff made does. And they would have to make these changes. I mean, we gave very detailed affidavits showing why, what the cost would be, and we're very conservative.
Do we have to look at the likelihood of success on the injunctive?
No, you don't, Your Honor. I think you have to, at this point, you don't look at the merits. I think you look at the question of, is there a plausible claim? And there is. And you don't go beyond the chances of him succeeding, because if you did, it would be sort of like a backwards, you'd be looking in your rearview mirror all the time. You might try a case, and we might prevail, and then you would have to say, well, we never had jurisdiction in the first place. I think you must look at whether there's a plausible claim at the time of the complaint, at the time of removal. I think that's the test under the Seventh Circuit, and that makes sense, too. But it's certainly, we were not aggregating the class cost of granting injunctive relief to plaintiff in her individual capacity only. I wanted to make that very clear. We thought we were clear in our affidavit. Perhaps we were not in our papers. But insurance is based on discrimination. It's one of the few industries in this country, especially in this time of political correctness, where we say, yes, we discriminate, and we're proud of it. It's the only way to properly price. And when you change one, then you have to change every policyholder in that class. Otherwise, you are giving someone is subsidizing someone else. And that's what the anti-discrimination statutes are all about. Insurance is heavily regulated, and that's our exposure. That's the object or the cost of this litigation and the object of the injunctive relief.
Well, I wonder if you might address the overlap then between the Kreidler case and this case.
Yes, Your Honor. In looking at Kreidler, in order to determine whether Kreidler is determinative of this case and that the case should not be brought or go forward because of Kreidler, I think, first of all, you have to do a three-part analysis. First of all, you have to see if Ms. Mikos was a member of the Kreidler class. If she's not, then it doesn't matter. And to determine that, you have to look at, first of all, was she, before we get to her policy, which I'll get to in a minute, and you alluded to it, did she opt out? Did she object? Did she appeal? No, she did none of that. Then you look at so we know she didn't attempt to opt out of the class, but was she in it in the first place? And to determine that, you look at the settlement agreement, you look at the terms, you look at the definition of policies. They're relying on one exception in the definition of policies.
You look at the definition of the class, obviously.
That's correct. The definition of class.
The
time frame of the class when the policies were purchased, right. And the definition of policies. And the only exception that they rely on in that definition is industrial policies, industrial life. They said that because the definition of policies excluded industrial life policies, and because she had an industrial life policy, then she's excluded from the class. What they don't look at, and when they make that argument, they look at the amended complaint. They look at the language in the amended complaint. They never address the definition in the settlement agreement. They completely ignore the intent of the parties, clear and ambiguous, as evidenced in the settlement agreement. And when you look at the settlement agreement, and you look at the definition of industrial policies, if those policies sold in 1981 and 82 with a policy number that begins with 81 or 82. It's Kurzweil. Even I can understand it. Despite that, despite the fact that in his original complaint, he alleges that the policies were purchased, I think, in 55 and 60 and 83, he never alleges his policy was purchased in 81 or 82, which would bring it into the definition. Despite that, he looks at the original or the amended complaint, which excludes industrial policies without a definition, and that's what he hangs his hat on. It's a completely intellectually dishonest argument that never addresses the papers that determine the outcome. And Judge Palmer picked on that very quickly. She picked up on it very quickly. So it's clear that she's a member of the class, or at least under the definition that they argued it, in which she should be opted out. She's clearly a member of the class. The next question is, were her claims preempted if she's a member of the class? And if you look at the class release, and you look at the deliberately broad language, which is frankly typical of many class releases, and I'm sure this court's very familiar with that, then certainly her claims come within the class release for several reasons. Number one, it uses language like any and all, known and unknown. It even has a provision that says the parties recognize that when you have such a broad release, there are unsuspected claims that are being given up. Clearly, the parties contemplated releasing all claims. And they used about every word in the English language I could think of that would apply to that. And the Western Southern paid for that broad release. They paid for buying peace because, frankly, that's the whole purpose of class settlements, is to reach finality. That settlement was worth between $40 and $50 million. So in addition to the language of the release being broad, it specifically applied to her claims because the release addresses claims pertaining to premium charges and premiums and failure to disclose what the proper premiums were. Those specific claims are discussed in the release. So in addition to the broad release, you have comfort in knowing that the specific claims are released. Now, the third and final thing you have to look at, I think in a class context, is was notice of this broad release given to the absent class members like Ms. Nikos? And the question there is, was notice mailed to the last known address? And we don't have that issue because they conceded they got the notice. They conceded that in their reply brief. They said the notice sent to Ms. Nikos. So we know she got the notice. And your final analysis is, was the notice adequate to put her, did it meet due process? And essentially that question, as you know, is was she properly informed of her rights, of her obligations, of her exposure if she acted or her exposure if she didn't act? And the class notice, which included the release, and I've seen a lot of class notices that don't include the release. This one, I think, went beyond, for example, the case of Bernardinelli, the Eighth Circuit decision from a few months ago. The release itself was included in the notice. And it talked again about releasing all claims known and unknown. She got the notice. She knew what her options were. It was in clear language. If she didn't understand it, there was an 800 number she could use to call to get more information. All of her exposure was explained that you would be waiving all your claims, that the court has already entered a preliminary injunction, and it will be made, the parties will ask that it be made final if you don't act and if you're included. I'm not sure what else that they could have said to her in this notice that would have explained it any more adequately. What plaintiff is requesting is that you engage in a federal court takeover of a state class action. That's what it is. Counts 2 through 4 of the amended complaint. He's claiming that the Kreidler case in Ohio state court was misadministered and that you, or through Judge Pallmeyer, should step in and take over the case.
Well, he's actually saying it's about something different. He's saying it's about these vanishing premium policies, not the kind of policies she had. And he also throws in the notion that Ms. Nikos, by this time, was herself quite elderly and in bad health and maybe suffering from some form of dementia. Maybe she didn't understand this notice that came to her.
Well, there was no medical testimony of that effect, Your Honor. And that was not addressed by the court. But he is asking you to take over this case because he does ask for an accounting, and he says it was misadministered. Mm-hmm. He's made no showing. He hasn't even made the proper allegations for any court to consider that, which I think would be highly unusual. He hasn't alleged that counsel was inadequate. He hasn't alleged that there was hanky-panky going on, as in the case, I think it was the Reynolds case, that he attached to his latest filing. He's never, to our knowledge, gone to the Kreidler court and asked for relief. The Kreidler court has retained jurisdiction of this case. It's administering it today. There's no evidence, there's no allegation of impropriety that the court was involved in any kind of fix for the trial lawyers. He's never made any type of allegation, and yet he's coming to you violating all principles of full faith and credit, comity, just the very federalism on which our country is based on, and he's saying, take it over. I have no proof, but if we look hard enough, we'll find something. Yeah. I guess my time's not up yet, but that's essentially what he's doing. He has made no showing. And he has not gone to the Kreidler court and been denied relief to have any plausible basis of saying that there's no relief to the Kreidler court. I think the obvious approach the court should take is deny his request on all counts. We have shown jurisdiction, I think, through not only through the injunctive relief analysis that we've done, but also through showing what the damages were. And we were very conservative in this case. We know what you've faced before. Parties who come in with less than $75,000, you try to pump it up. And just on one policy alone, the $3,500 that we talked about involved only one policy alone. There were other policies and other allegations that he made that I don't have time to discuss. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Santo. Mr. Holstein, how much time? You have 5 minutes, Mr. Holstein.
I don't think the law has changed in hundreds of years. The jurisdiction argument is not out of the case. It's not stipulated to. That can't be. That was the point. I think the district court may have bought that argument. My law school taught me I can't stipulate. It's not out of the case. It's not. It's for your honors to decide that. And I think the Seventh Circuit was very firm on that. And I thought the district court understood that. As far as the injunctive issue, looking at the plaintiff's case, it was an executed, completed, the lady was dead. It was gone. She had no injunctive. She, individually, which you have to look at, had no rights to injunction. All she had was damages. That's all was in the case on an individual basis. Now, with regard to the release, you can't, class action law, and I've been practicing, my first case was 3 months out of law school in 1962. You must start with the representative plaintiff. National Spud, it's right on point. You can't expand to be constitutionally fair to who you're representing. You can only represent those who you have an interest in. You can't represent the world in a class action. You can only represent your case. And we had a vanishing premium case. They can't expand that by virtue of a release and take in the world. That's the fundamental basis of due process in class action law. In National Spuds, it's classic, right on point. In the quote, I did my brief, in the present case, by contrast, the parties to the settlement have attempted to release claims with respect to which none of them were authorized to represent members of the class. It's just fundamental. That's what we have here. And all this nice talk and so forth, it doesn't change the fact. You can't, you just can't get rid of a whole lot of evils that you're not representative of. Otherwise, you would have had a different settlement. It would have been geared to that, and that's fundamental. Now, with regard to the difference in the cases, they've never responded to what we pointed out in our briefs, in our original, in our opening brief. The claims, if you look at the numbers. The claims cited by the notice, which have nothing to do with the Mickles claim, first, she was not claiming any wrongdoing with respect to how her debit insurance contract had been sold. They had a whole churning issue where insurance people come along and cash in paid-in policies and take out new policies. Now, that was in our original complaint, but it was not in our amended complaint because we realized that that had been covered. So we weren't complaining of that. So she wasn't complaining of how it was sold, which Credo did. Second, she was not claiming any wrongdoing with how it had performed. There was no, that's what a vanishing premium case is. You're going to get a return on your premium by virtue of dividends, which will pay for future premiums, therefore cut off your premiums as of a certain date by representation in the sales. That wasn't here. This was a level premium. It would pay for her death benefit, pay for her coffin and her funeral. That's it. Totally different tortious conduct. Thank you very much. On behalf of my client, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Holstein. Thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement. Next case.